You're listening to The Capital Minute, where we are teaching citizens about God and government minutes at a time. And on today's episode, we're doing our Capital Question and Answer with Pastor Perry. Today's question is, what is the true meaning and history behind the separation of church and state? And if you have followed any of Pastor Perry's guest appearances on podcasts or the Epic Times or Back to the Bible, you've heard this question come up. But today, I have a feeling he is going to unpack it unlike he has ever unpacked it before. So if you've ever been in a situation where you have shared your faith in a political space, or you've seen a political leader share their faith, or even just a Bible verse, and get the rebuttal, what about the separation of church and state? This episode is for you. So Pastor Perry, I'm excited for you to share with us the background and the true meaning of the separation of church and state.
Very good, Nate. It's great to be here again for another podcast episode, episode 20, Separating Church and State. Should we? Do we? What's all that about? As you said, Nate, it's a very common question. It's a very common objection, really. And by those who really don't understand it is what I find in my experience. People are constantly objecting, oh, wait a second, that's separation of church and state. And whenever I, as a minister or Christians or people of faith, are speaking into culture, into the public realm, into the political realm about their beliefs and their sincerely held religious beliefs, their opinions, with their free speech and their freedom of religion, people immediately jump up and say, hey, wait a second, that's a violation of the separation of church and state. Just recently on social media, the governor of Nebraska, Pete Ricketts, posted a Bible verse from the Old Testament. It was really quite insightful and fairly long. And I thought, wow, this is a little bit meaty here. And this is, you know, something as common as his declarations at Christmas and Easter, that Jesus is the reason for the season and things like this. And he will speak up. But people jumped all over him recently and saying, hey, how dare you get your religion in my politics. I'm a taxpayer and we pay you. And how dare you use the Bible? What about us who don't believe the Bible? And just objections left and right. And the governor gets it all the time, as if he doesn't have a right to freedom of religion and freedom of speech just because he's the governor. Well, he does have such a right. So the objections fly. Or the Secretary of HUD, Benjamin Solomon Carson Sr., General Ben Carson, when he was threatened by the Americans for Freedom from Religion, a bunch of atheists, decided to sue him for attending a Bible study in Washington, D.C. He said, go ahead, sue me. Number one, you won't win. The accusations were frivolous. But he said, studying the Bible makes me a better public servant. So why shouldn't a public servant have the right to believe, think about, and speak about their faith? They absolutely do. Well, Nate, we're going to look at a few things here. We'll start with a couple of scriptures that illustrate the separation of church and state in a proper way. And then we'll dive into the United States setting, the historical meaning of the phrase. Where does it come from? Where is it? Where is it not? Who said it? What did it mean to him? And how was it practiced in the foundation of our country? This goes back to the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson. But let's go to the Bible first and look at a couple verses. Jesus, in Mark chapter 12, verse 17, has that famous phrase, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and render unto God that which is God's. Now, Jesus was being tested by some religious leaders who wanted to basically just set him up for a fail. And they brought him a denarius and said, hey, should we pay taxes or not? And he said, well, whose picture is it? They said, Caesar's picture stamped on the coin. And he said, well, Caesar's image is on that coin. That coin represents governmental taxation and governmental issue. So yeah, go ahead and give that to him, basically saying, yes, it's lawful to pay your taxes. And then he went on to say, and throw God into the subject. And by the way, give to God that which is God. So in a sense, what he's doing here in this verse, he's saying there are two distinct spheres here. I know you're only talking about taxes, but I'm going to talk about God because there is another dynamic the world isn't just merely secular. So really, he's bringing up the distinction between the institution of government with its right to tax, established in Genesis 9:6, and the establishment and the difference of that from the kingdom of God and the things where God speaks to his people, tells them what to think, do, and believe. And in Matthew 18, Jesus says, I will build my church. But in the Old Testament church, we might call it, in that economy in which Jesus lived, there was a distinction between church and state. So let's look back to 2 Chronicles chapter 26, where this is a beautiful illustration of King Uzziah in the institution of state. Now people say, well, Israel was a theocracy. Well, yeah, the state and the church, so to speak, worked tightly together. There's a lot of silly discussion about theocracy. We'll get into that more in this podcast in future months. But in 2 Chronicles 26:17, it says that King Uzziah became strong, meaning politically, and his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly, and he was unfaithful to the Lord his God, for he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Now, a king in Solomon's temple was not allowed to go past the front porch and the pillar standing there. But he, this proud king, says, you know what? I'm pretty awesome stuff. I'm all that in a bag of chips, and man, I'm going into the sanctuary. Verse 17, then Azariah the priest entered after him, and with him 80 priests of the Lord, valiant men. Verse 18, they opposed King Uzziah and said to him, it is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord. You know, let's separate you. This isn't your realm, but it's for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. And I love this. Get out of the sanctuary, for you have been unfaithful and will have no honor from the Lord God. So they're saying, hey, there's a separation and you have crossed the line. Mr. King, you're a great king, you're prosperous, etc., etc., but you have crossed a line. So these 80 valiant priests speak truth to power, which says, get out of the sanctuary. And that's really a great way to think about separation of church and state right there. That is one of the most beautiful phrases to me as a theologian in the entire Bible about separation of church and state. And lo and behold, it's back in Israel's so-called theocracy, yet it was still separate. So the priests tell Uzziah, get out of the sanctuary. Hey, king, this holy place belongs to the church, to God's people, to those ordained for this special thing, not you. Verse 19, in conclusion, it says that King Uzziah had the censer in his hand and he was enraged. Kings can get mad when you tell them they're doing the wrong thing. And while he was enraged with the priest, leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priests in the house of the Lord beside the altar of incense. And that shows God's miraculous statement of disfavor and dishonor to a king who dishonored God, because the king knew that this was wrong to do. He was just arrogant and says, you know what? I'm the state and I'm going to control the church. I'm going to have my role everywhere. And we talked about statism in recent podcasts and how the danger of the state is that it swells and that it's not limited. King Uzziah here got a big head, and he thought his role in the institution of government could appropriately cross over into the institution of the state. And the priest said, get out of here. I love that phrase. Okay, well, let's shift gears from the Bible to the United States setting and the political historical context of separation of church and state. Well, I've got 6 points jotted down here. Number one, where is the phrase separation of church and state not found? Well, it's not found in the Constitution. I was just on a social media thread in a discussion with some people attacking a political leader, saying the leader had no right to bring up biblical truths that he held dear. And one of the people in the discussion said, hey, that's a violation of separation of church and state. It's in our Constitution. And I answered that person and said, in the Constitution? Question mark. Prove it. I love to say that to people who say separation of church and states is in our Constitution. It's not. It's nowhere to be found. So that's your good answer for those who say separation of church and states in the Constitution. It's not. Nor is it in the preceding document that must be linked forever to the Constitution, which is the Declaration of Independence. Nope, the phrase isn't in there. But I'll tell you what is in the Declaration is speaking of Creator God, who gives men unalienable rights, among them life and liberty. So point one, where is the phrase separation of church and state not found? It's not found in the Constitution. Number two, well, where is it found? The phrase originated historically in America at the pen tip of our third president, Thomas Jefferson. The president received a letter from the Danbury Baptist Church in Connecticut and the deacon elder Jeremiah Dodge. And these people wrote the president because they were concerned for the Congregational Church of Connecticut, which was the state church, because states could have an official church in a certain state. Maryland was, you might have guessed it, Catholic, and Pennsylvania was Quaker. So different states had a state denomination. Well, the Danbury Baptist wrote President Jefferson with concerns that he might use his influence and interfere with their freedom of religion as Baptists in Connecticut. They wrote him on October 7, 1801, but he delayed his reply until January 1st of 1802. And in the famous letter that in American history for the first time contains this phrase, the separation of church and state, Jefferson writes them and he basically says, let me summarize it for you, that the founding of America and its people and its Congress have put things in place, namely the First Amendment, which is linked to the Constitution. And by doing that, they have built a wall of separation. And that wall was to keep people like Thomas Jefferson, though the president, the chief official of the land, the highest office, to keep even him out of the business of the church. And so he's saying religion is a private matter. It's up to the churches to have their religious freedom. And don't worry, I'll stay out of it because of the wall that is the will of the people. This wall of separation is the will of the people. Keep the government out of the business of the church. That's where the phrase originated. Point number three, what did the separation of church and state mean in their context in the time of 1802, 1801, and the establishment of the nation? What did it mean back then? Because that's what matters, because these are founding documents. These are foundational thoughts. These are the founding fathers. And here's what it meant, that the Congress would not establish a national denomination. The population of the United States was 98.4% professing Protestants. It was 1.2% professing Catholics. That totals 99.6% of the population professed, at least professed some sort of Christianity. So when the First Amendment talks about Congress not establishing a religion, they are talking in the context of a thoroughly Christianized America, at least in ethic and worldview. So next, that relates directly to number four, how Congress legalized this concept. They didn't legalize the phrase because the phrase isn't in the founding documents, but in the First Amendment, which is an amendment to the Constitution, and the Constitution is our national supreme law, they legalized it this way, the concept that I'm talking about. They said, Congress shall make no law establishing a religion. And what they meant in context, 99.6% of the population profess some sort of Christianity. What they meant is Congress shall not form one national denomination. You see, the founding fathers fled from England, where the Anglican Church was the church of the nation. And if you didn't bow down and participate in Anglicanism, in the church of the state, of the national body of Great Britain, then you could be put in stocks, put in prison, even killed. So the founders who fled here for religious freedom said, we're not going to have any of that on this soil. So Congress shall make no law. We're talking about a law here that establishes one denomination. That's what it means. So Congress made this concept legal in a prohibitive way, saying Congress may not, the founders said Congress, the lawmaking body, they may not make a law that says there's an Anglican national church or the Catholic national church, unlikely with 1.2%, or the Baptists or the Congregationalists or the Quakers or the national church of the nation. That's what they're talking about. So the First Amendment has nothing to do with a valedictorian who's giving her speech before her class and she wants to mention Jesus Christ. It has nothing to do with the football captain who takes a knee at the high school football game and wants to open the contest in prayer. That's not Congress. That's not a law. Those are individuals expressing their freedom of religion and their freedom of speech. And even a coach in a public school who wants to lead a team in prayer or even say a prayer for a member of his classroom who may have experienced a personal tragedy or death in the family, he has every right, if that's his faith, he has every right to caringly lead and exercise his faith. So point number five, how did the author of the phrase, Thomas Jefferson, how did he live it out? When I get into these tangling matches with secularists and atheists and humanists who like to say, get your religion out of my politics, I like to, first of all, ask them, okay, where's the phrase found? I'll wait. And they can't tell you, or they'll say, in the Constitution. And then I have the privilege to correct them and point them to the place where it really is found. Then I like to say, especially if they're picking on an elected leader, a lawmaker or a governor or a member of the cabinet, I like to tell them, well, since we've established that it's President Thomas Jefferson that made that phrase famous, let's look at how he lived it out. He was the president of the United States. And I love to point this out to them. Did you know that President Thomas Jefferson oversaw and ensured that worship services were conducted inside the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. every Sunday. And he assured that the Navy band itself was there to lead in singing praise and worship music right in the U.S. Capitol building. Now, there's some church going on. When Jefferson was asked why he so faithfully attended, and by the way, Jefferson was not the most religious of the founders, he replied that he needs to be a good role model for the citizens of the United States. He understood how the church does and should have a penetrating influence within the halls of power, within the buildings of government. The church must influence the state, and President Jefferson lived that out. So he is not contradicting what he wrote, because the church can have influence on the state. A few other things I'll mention quickly. The Aitken Bible, A-I-T-K-E-N, the Aitken Bible in 1782 was a Bible called the Bible of the Revolution. It was actually printed with congressional authorization in 1872, and the Congress basically said that they recommended this edition of the Bible to the inhabitants of the United States. And hereby, they authorized Mr. Aitken to publish this in the way he saw best fit. By the way, it fit within a soldier's coat pocket. And so, isn't that interesting that even the military, which is an arm of the government, the soldiers need to have God's word. And so here's these Bibles penetrating the military garb of that arm of the government. Jefferson also, as president, signed legislation to designate congressional money for missionaries to reach the American Indians. So how did the founder of this phrase, separation church and state, how did he live it out? Not at all like people think today would be proper. Going to worship, printing Bibles, sending missionaries. Why? Because the institution of church is to influence the state. The state, though, has no business. Get out of the sanctuary. The state has no business trying to control the freedom of the churches. Whether you're Baptist, Congregationalist, whatever you are, it is not the business of the state to control the church. But the church may and must influence the state. And I'll end with that, Nate. A key distinction and a good way to think about this one-way valve, this wall of separation that exists to keep the federal congressional government and its lawmaking power away from the freedom of the church and free religion and free speech. A nice distinction, I like to say, is that there is an institutional separation between church and state. They're two different things in society. They accomplish two different purposes under God in society. So they're institutionally separate, but not influentially. So the church must influence the state, but the state may not dictate to the church. That is what is meant by the wall of separation, as Thomas Jefferson quoted and referred to the First Amendment and the will of the people. Get out of the sanctuary is really Jefferson's mode. He understood it. And so the way people think of separation of church and state, I like to say it's a myth. It's a total myth. The culture has come to believe that it means the exact opposite of what it really believes. The average guy on the street thinks that separation of church and state means that the church cannot have any influence, presence, voice within the public realm. Ridiculous. It means the opposite. The state has got to stay out of the church. It may not restrict our freedom of religion and our freedom of speech. Well, there's a chunk of speech, Nate, and there's some theology and some history to help us understand. How do we separate church and state? Well, we do what the Bible does. It has them separated institutionally, but not influentially. So I want to encourage you Christians, especially in this holiday season, be about speaking of the things of God, of your faith in the public square, share it anywhere, everywhere. There is no restriction on your freedom of religion and your freedom to speak it. And in America, which is still the greatest country in world history, in my opinion, we have this very foundational freedom. And so that we don't lose it, we need to be like those bold priests, those 80 men of valor who speak up and speak truth to power and tell the state, get out of the sanctuary. For the Capitol Minute, I'm Perry Gothier.
Thank you for listening to the Capitol Minute. Since this was an in-depth episode about the question of the separation of church and state, we will release a shorter version for episode 22, so you can easily share the most informative parts of this message about what the separation of church and state really means with those that you think need a little bit of help understanding it. Also, let me ask, are you praying for your local and national political leaders? Do you even know who they are? Email faith@capitalstudies.org to join our prayer team so you can learn who you should be praying for and how to pray for them. Take action today to grow as an informed and effective Christian citizen.